From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Until people hear about what is going on with this war, it will continue to happen and people will continue to die. I'm sorry for the things that I did. I am no longer the monster that I once was. Thank you.
Former Marine John Turner, Winter Soldier. U.S. veterans and active duty soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan gathered in Maryland this weekend to testify about the horrors of war. While the corporate media ignored the story, we'll broadcast their voices. Then this weekend also marked the 40th anniversary of the My Lai massacre, when U.S. troops killed more than 500 men, women, and children in Vietnam. We'll speak with investigative journalist Seymour Hersh, who won a Pulitzer Prize for exposing the killings and the cover-up. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Federal Reserve took dramatic action last night on multiple fronts to avert a crisis of the global financial system. On Sunday, the Fed helped J.P. Morgan purchase the investment bank Bear Stearns in effort to save the nation's fifth-largest investment bank from collapse. The Fed also announced an emergency quarter-point cut in its discount rate. It's also agreed to become the lender of last resort for other investment banks in an effort to prevent firms from going under. The Wall Street Journal reports this marks one of the broadest expansions of the Fed's lending authority since the 1930s. The fall of Bear Stearns has shocked the business community. J.P. Morgan bought the company for just $270 million. A year ago, Bear Stearns was valued at $20 billion. As part of the deal, the Federal Reserve agreed to lend J.P. Morgan $30 billion to secure some of Bear Stearns' mortgage investments. If the assets decline in value, the U.S. taxpayer will bear the cost. The government-led bailout is the first of its kind since the Great Depression. In response to the bailout of Bear Stearns, stock markets in Asia and Europe tumbled. Meanwhile, the price of oil has jumped to a new all-time high, nearly $112 a barrel. While more than 70% of economists now believe the nation is in a recession, President Bush continues to insist the foundation of the economy is solid. He spoke Friday at the Economic Club of New York.
So I'm coming to you as an optimistic fellow. I've seen what happens when America deals with difficulty. I believe that we're a resilient economy. And I believe that the ingenuity and resolve of the American people is what helps us deal with these issues. And it's going to happen again.
Also on Friday, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson defended the Federal Reserve's efforts to bail out Bear Stearns.
I think we made the right decision. I think the Federal Reserve made the right decision here. And again, I don't know what to say other than what I've just said is we've got strong financial institutions. Our markets are the envy of the world. They're resilient. They're innovative. They're flexible. I think we move very quickly to address situations in this country.
In other economic developments, new government statistics confirm what many grocery store shoppers already know. Food prices are soaring. In the past year, the price of milk has risen 17%. Rice, pasta, and bread prices have jumped over 12%. And the price of eggs has risen by 25%. It's the highest grocery inflation since the early 1990s. In world news, over 80 people are feared dead in Tibet following a wave of anti-government protests against Chinese rule. Tibet's spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, accused China of waging cultural genocide. Protests began a week ago when Buddhist monks took to the streets of Lhasa to mark the anniversary of the 1959 uprising against Chinese rule. Protests then spread to other Chinese provinces with Tibetan populations. Hundreds of Chinese soldiers are now patrolling Lhasa following an outbreak of violence on Friday when Tibetan protesters set fire to Chinese-owned shops. China has issued an ultimatum to protesters to surrender by midnight tonight or face harsh punishment. The Tibetan Center for Human Rights and Democracy reports hundreds of Tibetans have already been arrested. China has also barred foreign reporters from Tibet and blocked access to many websites, including YouTube, where video of the protests have been posted over the past week. The demonstrations come less than 200 days before the start of the Summer Olympics in Beijing. Tibetans living in exile have been holding protests across the globe. In New York, several hundred Tibetans and supporters gathered outside the Chinese consulate on Saturday.
Struggling to get freedom and independence for our country for 50 years with the peaceful means or nonviolence. And there is not much, no fruitful result for it. So, and I think if this problem is not resolved soon, there'll be a different approach from the youngsters. The youngsters are getting frustrated.
Another protester criticized China's human rights record.
We don't want the Chinese to get away with all the things that they're doing in their own country. I mean, it's not only in Tibet. In China, their own people don't have that freedom. And also, they are influencing in Dafa. They are talking about the Chinese influence there, too. I mean, they are affecting people all over the world, and not in a good way. And that's what we think of when we think of Olympics. We want it to go to a nation that appreciates basic human rights.
In news from Iraq, Senator John McCain and Vice President Dick Cheney have made separate, unannounced visits to Iraq ahead of the fifth anniversary of the U.S. invasion. McCain claimed his visit was a fact-finding venture, not a campaign photo opportunity. Cheney's on a 10-day visit to the Middle East, including Saudi Arabia, Israel, the West Bank, and Turkey. Cheney started his trip on Sunday, exactly 5 years after he predicted the U.S. will be greeted in Iraq as, quote, liberators, a claim John McCain later supported. Meanwhile, a new survey has found more than two-thirds of Iraqis believe U.S.-led coalition forces should leave. A quarter of those surveyed said they'd lost a family member to murder since the war began. President Bush told U.S. troops in Afghanistan he was, quote, a little envious of them. In a video conference last week, Bush said, quote, if I were slightly younger and not employed here, I think it would be a fantastic experience to be on the front lines of helping this young democracy succeed. Bush went on to say, quote, it must be exciting for you, in some ways romantic, in some ways, you know, confronting danger. You're really making history, and thanks. In news from Capitol Hill, the House has voted to reject giving telecommunications companies immunity for participating in the government's warrantless wiretapping program. By a 213-197 vote, the Democratic-led House passed the measure despite a threatened veto by President Bush. U.S. officials have admitted the CIA has been holding an Afghan man named Mohammad Rahim in a secret overseas prison. Last week, Rahim was transferred to the military prison at Guantanamo. The Bush administration has refused to say where they captured Rahim or where he's been held. He's accused of being a member of Al-Qaeda and a translator for Osama bin Laden. In Richmond, California, 24 activists were arrested Saturday at demonstrations outside a Chevron oil refinery. Protesters criticized Chevron's plan to upgrade the refinery as well as the war in Iraq. At the rally, Richmond Mayor Gail McLaughlin told the crowd, it's time to clear the air and say no more pollution, no more war, and no more lies. And Sunday marked the fifth anniversary of the death of Rachel Corrie. On March 16, 2003, an Israeli military bulldozer crushed Corrie to death as she tried to stop the demolition of a home of a Palestinian pharmacist in the Gaza town of Rafah. Eyewitnesses said Rachel was standing directly in the path of the bulldozer, holding a megaphone, wearing a fluorescent jacket. She was 23 years old. On Sunday, the play My Name is Rachel Corrie was performed for the first time in Israel. The play was performed in Arabic in the Israeli city of Haifa. It's scheduled to tour Israel and the occupied West Bank. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Iraq and Afghanistan veterans and gathered in Maryland this past weekend to testify at Winter Soldier, an eyewitness indictment of atrocities committed by U.S. troops during the ongoing occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Organized by Iraq Veterans Against the War, the event was modeled after the historic 1971 Winter Soldier hearings held during the Vietnam War. over the weekend. War veterans spoke of free fire zones, the shootings and beatings of innocent civilians, racism at the highest levels of the military, sexual harassment and assault within the military, and the torturing of prisoners. Well, the Winter Soldier was held just outside the nation's capital. It was almost entirely ignored by the American corporate media. A search on the Lexis database found no major television network or cable news network even mentioned Winter Soldier over the weekend. Neither did the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times, or most other major newspapers in the country. The editors of the Washington Post chose to cover Winter Soldier but placed the article in the local section. On Friday, Democracy Now! Broadcast from Winter Soldier. This week, we play excerpts from the proceedings. We begin with John Michael Turner, who fought with the 3rd Battalion, 8th Marines.
Good afternoon. My name is John Michael Turner. I currently reside in Burlington, Vermont. I served with Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 8th Marines as an automatic machine gunner. There's a term, once a Marine, always a Marine. But there's also the term, eat the apple, F the Corps. I don't work for you no more.
That was John Michael Turner stripping his medals and ribbons from his chest and throwing them into the audience to the applause of attendees at Winter Soldier. Turner then went on to describe some of his time in Iraq.
On April 18th, 2006, I had my first confirmed kill. This man was innocent. I don't know his name. I called him the Fat Man. He was walking back to his house, and I shot him in front of his friend and his father. The first round didn't kill him after I had hit him up here in his neck area. And afterwards, he started screaming and looked right into my eyes. So I looked at my friend who I was on post with, and I said, well, I can't let that happen. So I took another shot and took him out. He was then carried away by the rest of his family. It took 7 people to carry his body away. We were all congratulated after we had our first kills, and that happened to have been mine. My company commander personally congratulated me, as he did everyone else in our company. This is the same individual who had stated that whoever gets their first kill by stabbing them to death will get a 4-day pass when we return from Iraq. There's one incident where we got into a firefight just south of the government center, about 2,000 meters. We had no idea where the fire was coming from, and the way our rules of engagement were, pinpoint where the fire is coming from and throw a rocket at it. So with that being said, we still didn't know where the fire was coming from. And an 84 millimeter rocket was shot into a house. I do not know if there was anyone in it. We do not know if that's where the fire was coming from, but that's what was done. Please go to the next image. This man right here was my 3rd confirmed kill. As you can see, he was riding his bicycle. This later on in the day, we went ahead and we had CBS Laura Logan with us, but she was with the other squad. And so she wasn't with us. So myself and 2 other people went ahead and took out some individuals because we were excited about the firefight we had just gone into, and we didn't have a cameraman or woman with us. With that being said, anytime we did have embedded reporters with us, our actions would change drastically. We never acted the same. We were always on key with everything, did everything by the books. Though the man on the bicycle, he was left in the street for about 10 minutes until we realized that we needed to leave where we were. And his body was dragged about 10 feet to the right of him, where his body was thrown behind a rock wall and his bicycle was thrown on top of him. Another thing that we used to do a lot was recon by fire, where we would go ahead and try to start a firefight if we felt threatened in any way, shape, or form. There's one particular incident where we were working with the Iraqi Army and the Iraqi Special Forces in downtown Ramadi. And with our squad and the Iraqi army. There is also lieutenant colonels, majors, first sergeants, and sergeant majors. Sorry, sergeant major. With that being said, the Iraqi army would go into the house, kick in the doors, and then go ahead and shoot. And there were loud bursts of machine gun fire. We thought we were taking fire, but then we later found out that it was them. House raids. Because we were a grunt battalion, we were responsible for going on several patrols. A lot of the raids and patrols we did were at the night, around 3 o'clock in the morning, around there. And what we would do is just kick in the doors and terrorize the families. That was an image taken around 3 o'clock in the morning through night vision goggles. And that is the segregation of the women and children and the men. If the men of the household were giving us problems, we'd go ahead and take care of them any way we felt necessary, whether it be choking them or slamming their head against the walls. If you go back to that one picture, that was one man that wasn't taken, that was taken care of in a very bad way. Because of all the wiring that he had, we considered it IED making material. On my wrist, there's Arabic for FU. I got that put on my wrist just 2 weeks before we went to Iraq because that was my choking hand. And anytime I felt the need to take out aggression, I would go ahead and use it. Please go to the next picture. Next. There's an instance of detainees and how they were treated in a nice manner. Next. That is the Fatemat Mosque minaret. As you can see, it is written with bullet holes and holes in the top of it. Those were from mortars. And the next video that I'm going to show you is a tank round that went into that minaret, where we weren't sure if we were taking fire or not. I'll talk about this one. This is after one of the guys in a weapons company had gotten shot. This is a way that we would take out our aggression. For those of you who don't know, it is illegal to shoot into a mosque unless you were taking fire from it. There was no fire that was taken from that mosque. It was shot into because we were angry. Can you please play the next video? Next image. That, okay. With that being said, there's many more stories and incidents for me to talk about, although we don't have the time to. But this just goes to show you that that was the after effect of the tank round. This just goes to show you that everyone sitting up here has these stories. And there's been over a million troops that have gone in and out of Iraq. So the possibilities are endless. Next image, please. The reason I am doing this today is not only for myself and for the rest of society to hear, but it's for all those who can't be here to talk about the things that we went through, talk about the things that we did. Next image. Those four crosses and this memorial service were for the five guys in Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 8th Marines that we lost. Throughout our unit, we had 18 that got killed. With that being said, that is my testimony. I just want to say that I am sorry for the hate and destruction that I've inflicted on innocent people. And I'm sorry for the hate and destruction that others have inflicted on innocent people. At one point, it was okay. But reality has shown that is not, and that this is happening, and that until people hear about what is going on with this war, it will continue to happen, and people will continue to die. I am sorry for the things that I did. I am no longer the monster that I once was. Thank you.
Former Marine John Michael Turner fought with the 3rd Battalion, 8th Marines. The videos and photos the soldiers showed can be seen at our website, democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Shiraz by Sharif here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we return now to our coverage of Winter Soldier, Iraq and Afghanistan.
My name is Jason Hurd. I recently completed 10 years of honorable service to my country in both the U.S. Army and the Tennessee National Guard. I served in central Baghdad from November of 2004 to November of 2005. I'm from a little place nestled in the mountains of East Tennessee called Kingsport, and hence the mountain man beard. People don't really trust you if you're clean shaven there. Kingsport is truly small town America. There is a Baptist church on every street corner, and even the high class restaurants serve biscuits and gravy. My father, Carl C. Hurd, who died in 2000, he was 76 years old. He was a Marine during World War II. Obviously, I was a latecomer in his life. He didn't have me until in his late 50s. As a matter of fact, when he died shortly after that, I have the two World War II battles he participated in tattooed on my arm, and my father had the same tattoo. He was in the Pacific Campaign and participated in the battles of Tarawa and Guadalcanal, which were some of the bloodiest occurrences of that war. I decided to join the military in 1997. I was 17 years old. I had just graduated from high school, and I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do with my life. My father was adamantly opposed to me serving in the military. My father was one of the most warmongering, gun-loving people you could ever meet. But he didn't feel that way when it came to his son because he knew the negative psychological consequences of combat service. Looking back, I know for a fact that my father had post-traumatic stress disorder. He had the rage, he had the nightmares, and he had the flashbacks.
Jason Hurd went on to describe his time in Iraq. In 2004, he was deployed to central Baghdad with Tennessee's 278th Regimental Combat Team.
One of the observation points that overlooked the Tigris River looked out at the old Republican Guard barracks, which were across the river. And there was one of those buildings that was sort of dilapidated. However, we knew that squatters had taken this building over, and we actually used to make jokes that this place looked like a crack house and that they were running drugs out of there. We had no evidence of that. It was just joking. One day, Iraqi police got into an exchange of gunfire with some unknown individuals around that building. some of the stray rounds came across the Tigris River and hit the shield of one of our Hummers. The gunner atop that Hummer decided to open fire with his 50 caliber machine gun into that building. He expended about a case and a half of ammunition. And I'm no weapons expert, I'm a medic, but I talked to some of my colleagues just the other night, and to put this into perspective for you all, each case of 50 cal ammunition holds about 150 rounds. A case and a half is well over 200 rounds. Over 200 rounds of 50 caliber ammunition could take out just about every single person in this room. We fired indiscriminately and unnecessarily at this building. We never got a body count. We never got a casualty count afterwards. Another unit came through and swept up that mess. Ladies and gentlemen, things like that happen every day in Iraq. We react out of fear, fear for our lives, and we cause complete and utter destruction. After we finished the mission manning those observation points, we moved on. My platoon specifically was tasked with running security escort for two explosive ordnance teams, one U.S. Navy and one Australian EOD team. On day one, the U.S. Navy team took us all aside for some specialized training. They took us aside and said, look, EOD teams are some of the most highly targeted entities in Iraq. The reason being is because, hey, we're the guys that go out and we disarm car bombs. We mess up the tactics and the operations of the insurgency. That's why we're highly targeted. So you guys have to use more aggressive tactics to protect us. And they explained to us that what we were to do is keep a 50-meter perimeter, a 50-meter bubble around our trucks at all times, whether we're driving down the road or whether we're stationary. And if anything comes in that 50-meter bubble, we're to get it out immediately. If it doesn't want to move, we use what are called levels of aggression. Your first option is to try to push it out by using hand signals, hand and arm signals. Your next option is to fire a warning shot into the ground. And from there on, you walk bullets up the car, and your last option is to shoot the person driving the car. This is for our own protection. Car bombs are a real danger in Iraq, and in fact, that's the vast majority of what I saw in Baghdad is car bombings. My unit adhered strictly to these guidelines for a few weeks. But as time went on and the absurdity of war sat in, they started taking things too far. Individuals from my unit indiscriminately and unnecessarily opened fire on innocent civilians as they're driving down the road on their own streets. My unit, individuals from my platoon, would fire into the grills of these cars and then come back in the evenings after missions were done and brag about it. They would say, hey, did you guys see that car I shot at? It spewed radiator fluid all over the ground. Wasn't that cool? I remember thinking back on that and how appalled I was that we were bragging about these things, that we were laughing. But that's what you do in a combat zone. That is your reality. That is how you deal with that predicament. After we finished the EOD escort missions, we moved on to another mission, patrolling the Kendi Street area, which is right outside of the Green Zone. Kendi Street is a relatively upscale neighborhood. Some of the houses in the Kendi area would cost well over $1 million here in America. This area, from what we were told, had no violent activity at all up until the point we started patrolling this area. We were the first U.S. military to do so on any regular basis. So we went in, we started doing patrols through the streets. We started getting out, meeting and greeting the local population, trying to figure out what sort of issues they had, how we could resolve those issues. I remember we were out on a patrol one day, a dismounted patrol, and we were walking by a woman's house. She was outside in her garden doing some work. We had our interpreter with us, and our interpreter threw up his hand and said, Salaam Alaikum, which is their greeting in Iraq. It means peace of God be with you. And he translated back to us what she said. She said, "No, no peace of God be with you." She was angry and she was frustrated. And so we stopped and our interpreter said, "Well, what's the matter? Why are you so angry? We're here protecting you. We're here to ensure your safety." And that woman began to tell us a story. Just a few months prior to this, her husband had been shot and killed by a United States convoy because he got too close to their convoy. He was not an insurgent. He was not a terrorist. He was merely a working man trying to make a living for his family. To make matters worse, a few weeks later, there was a special forces team who operated in the Kindy area. And as you know, special forces do clandestine operations. And so even though this was my unit's area of operation, we didn't know what the special forces teams were actually doing there. They holed up in a building there in the Kindy Street area and made a compound out of it. A few weeks after this man died, the special forces team got some intelligence that this woman was supporting the insurgency. And so they conducted a raid on her home, zip-tied her and her two children, threw them on the floor. And I guess her son was old enough to be perceived as a possible threat, so they detained him and took him away. For the next 2 weeks, this woman had no idea whether her son was alive, dead, or worse. At the end of that 2 weeks, the special forces team rolled up, dropped her son off, and without so much as an apology, drove off. It turns out they had acted on bad intelligence. Ladies and gentlemen, things like that happen every day in Iraq. We are harassing these people. We are disrupting their lives. I want to tell you a very personal story. And I want you all to bear with me because this is always difficult for me to tell. One day we were on another dismounted patrol through the Kindy Street area. We were walking past an area we called the Garden Center because it was literally a fenced off garden. As is policy, we are to keep all cars and individuals away from our formation. And so a car was approaching us from the front. I was at the rear of the formation because I was the medic, and the medics hang out at the back with the platoon sergeant in case anything happens up front so you can respond. They waved the car off down a side street so that it would not come near our formation. As I made it up to that side street, the car had turned around and was coming back towards us because the street was blocked off by a concrete T barrier at the other end. So I began doing my levels of aggression. I held up my hand, trying to get the car to stop. The car sped up. And I thought to myself, oh my God, this is it. This is someone who is trying to hurt us. And so instead of doing what I should have done according to policy and raising my weapon, instead I did what you should never do, and I took my hands off of my weapon altogether and began jumping up and down, waving my hands back and forth, trying to get this car to stop and see me. The car kept coming. And so I raised my weapon, and the car kept coming. I pulled my selector switch off of safe, and the car kept coming. I was applying pressure to my trigger, getting ready to fire on the vehicle. And out of nowhere, a man came off of the side of the road, flagged the car down, and got it to pull over. He walked around to the driver's side door, opened it up, and out popped an 80-year-old woman. Come to find out, this woman was a highly respected figure in the community, and I don't have a clue what would have happened had I opened fire on this woman. I would imagine a riot. Ladies and gentlemen, I hate guns. I spent 10 years in the military, and I carried two of them on my side in Iraq, but I think they should be melted down and turned into jewelry. To this day, that is the worst thing that I've ever done in my life. I am a peaceful person, but yet in Iraq, I drew down on an 80-year-old geriatric woman who could not see me because I was in front of a desert-colored building wearing desert-colored camouflage. Another personal story from my experience. The next mission that we got was to man the main checkpoint that entered into the Green Zone. We call this checkpoint Slaughterhouse 11. because the very first day we got into country, a car bomb went off in that checkpoint. We were a couple of blocks away at the time, and none of us knew what it was, so we were asking around, what was that? What was that? Oh, that's the car bomb that goes off every single morning at checkpoint 11. And that's where the name Slaughterhouse 11 comes from. You could literally set your watch by the time a car bomb would explode in that checkpoint every day. Towards the end of my tour, we got the mission to take that checkpoint over. And my unit said, what is the matter with you people? We're getting ready to go home in just a couple of months. Why are you giving us Slaughterhouse 11? Are you wanting us to die? Day one that we took that checkpoint over and ran it ourselves, a car bomb drove into it and exploded. We found out that there was over 1,000 pounds of explosives in that car afterwards. Luckily, it did not hurt any of my guys. My guys were able to find cover, and it didn't hurt them. But it killed untold numbers of Iraqi civilians in queue to come into the checkpoint and injured so many more. I treated 5 people that day myself, and I would imagine 20 or 30 others got carted off into civilian ambulances before I could get to them. But I have an image that is burned into my mind to this very day. And I remember a man running towards me at the front of the checkpoint carrying a young 17 or 18-year-old Iraqi guy, very thin, very sort of pale. He came running to me with this guy and laid him at my feet. I looked down at him, and the guy was missing from here to here of his arm, and his forearm was only held on by a small flap of skin. The bones were protruding, and it was bleeding profusely. He had shrapnel wounds all over his torso, and when I log-rolled him onto his side to check his rear for wounds, I noticed that his entire left butt cheek was missing, and it was bleeding profusely, and it was pooling blood. And to this day, I have that image burned in my mind's eye. Almost every couple of days, I will get a flash of red color in my mind's eye, and it won't have any shape, no form, just a flash of red, and every time I associate it with that instant. So not only are we disrupting the lives of Iraqi civilians, but we're disrupting the lives of our veterans with this occupation. You know, conservative statistics say that the majority of Iraqis support attacks against coalition forces. The majority of Iraqis support us leaving immediately. And the majority of Iraqis see us as the main contributors to the violence in Iraq. This gives us a view at the prevailing sentiment in Iraq. And I like to explain it to everyone this way, especially in the South, because it rings with some semblance of truth to people down there. If a foreign occupying force came here to the United States, and regardless of what they told us, whether they told us they were here to free us, to liberate us, and to give us democracy, do you not think that every person that owns a shotgun would not come out of the hills and fight for their right to self-determination? To sum it up like this, the prevailing sentiment in Iraq is this. Another time that I was out on patrol in the Kendi Street area, as I said, part of our mission was to meet and greet the local population and find out what their problems were. And so I approached a man with my interpreter on the side of the road, and I asked him, I said, look, are your lives better because we're here? Are you safer? Do you feel more secure? Do you feel like we are liberating you? And that man looked at me straight in the eye, and he said, Mister, we Iraqis know that you have good intentions here. But the fact of the matter is, before America invaded, we didn't have to worry about car bombs in our neighborhoods. We didn't have to worry about the safety of our own children as they walk to school. And we didn't have to worry about U.S. soldiers shooting at us as we drive up and down our own streets. Ladies and gentlemen, the suffering in Iraq is tearing that country apart, and ending that suffering begins with a complete and immediate withdrawal of all of our troops. Thank you very much.
Jason Hurd was with Tennessee's 278th Regimental Combat Team in Iraq. He testified at the Winter Soldier hearings this weekend at the National Labor College in Silver Spring, Maryland, joining hundreds of other active duty and veterans from both Afghanistan and Iraq. The Winter Soldier hearings were modeled on what happened 37 years ago in Detroit, Michigan, the Winter Soldier investigation where soldiers from Vietnam came back and described atrocities they themselves had been involved with. We will continue to run these testimony throughout the week on this fifth anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Stay with us. It's back in Vietnam. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 700 stations, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks. On Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are available in Spanish for any radio station to take at democracynow.org, and they're also there in transcript form. Today, we begin our series 1968, 40 years later. This weekend marked the 40th anniversary of the My Lai Massacre. On March 16, 1968, the members of Charlie Company arrived in the village of My Lai in the northern province of South Vietnam. The soldiers opened fire, even though they had not come under attack. The violence quickly escalated into an orgy of killing. More than 500 villagers were murdered, most of them women, children, and the elderly. When the massacre was uncovered, it proved to be a turning point for American public opinion about the war. The only U.S. soldier convicted over the killings was Lieutenant William Calley. On Sunday, more than 1,000 people turned out in My Lai to remember the victims. The memorial drew Vietnamese survivors and family members, returning U.S. war veterans, peace activists, and a delegation of atomic bomb survivors from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Among those attending was Larry Colburn. He was a member of a three-man U.S. Army helicopter crew that landed in the midst of the massacre and intervened to stop the killing.
No one wins in war, and civilians always suffer in war. And the only way to prevent atrocities in war is to prevent war.
While the My Lai Massacre took place on March 16, 1968, it wasn't until November 12, 1969, that the world found out about it. That's when investigative journalist Seymour Hersh broke the story about the massacre and its cover-up. He was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for his exposé. 40 years later, Seymour Hersh is still breaking stories about war. In 2004, he exposed the Abu Ghraib scandal in The New Yorker magazine. Seymour Hersh joins us now from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Cy.
Good morning.
Let's go back 40 years ago. Tell us what happened on that day.
Well, what happened is this is a unit. Look, the analogy with Iraq is pretty acute. Basically, it's a group of soldiers that landed. They were mostly uneducated, high school graduates and dropouts. Who were told they were fighting communism, going to save America. They got to Vietnam. They spent 10, 11 weeks in the, you know, humping it in the boonies in the villages and paddies of South Vietnam, and never saw the enemy. Maybe they lost 15 or 20% of their company through snipers, landmines, et cetera. but they never engaged. And over the period of 10, 11, 12 weeks between the period they landed around New Year's Day of 68 until March 16th, they became increasingly brutal. Sort of randomly going through a village and whacking people. Sometimes an old man they saw, one soldier would just hit him with a rifle butt and nobody said anything. Because what happens inevitably is when you don't see an organized enemy and you lose people, you lose your buddies and your mates and you're angry, you take it out on the villagers, you take it out on the civilian population, as you were just hearing, we were all listening this morning to the testimony. And so one night they were told, the kids were told, tomorrow you're going to meet the enemy. The North Vietnamese, a regular North Vietnamese battalion is going to be there and you get a chance to get payback. And the kids did then what they did then. The young soldiers toked it up and the senior enlisted men and the officers drank it up. But they all got up at 3 or 4 in the morning, jumped on choppers and went to kill and be killed. You have to give them their due. And they got into the village and there's no soldiers there. The intelligence was bad, as it always is. And they gathered people. There was no fire at all, really, just old women, men, and children making their heating up water for their morning rice. And they gathered them eventually into three large ditches and began to execute them. Callie became infamous, but there were 5 or 6 first and second lieutenants that were also organizing it. And as I later wrote and learned about, I spent a couple of years sort of obsessing with it, wrote a couple of books about it. One was about the cover-up. Almost during the day, every senior officer, including the major general in charge of the AmeriCal Division, this group was assigned to the AmeriCal Division, all were flying over the area at one time. And pretty much everybody knew pretty much what was going on. There you are. And I'll tell you, Amy, just there was one of the kids who did a lot of shooting. Was a young man named Paul Meadlow from a little small hamlet called New Goshen, Indiana. And talk about repressed memory. I learned about this almost a year and a half later. I was working in Washington as a freelance writer, and I had followed the war and knew what was going on in some visceral way and knew there was something there. And I finally got to the point where I began to find kids in the unit, and I was writing stories. I think I wrote 5 in 5 weeks as a freelancer. And it was just as the young boys talking over the weekend were ignored by the press. I had a hell of a time getting the major press to run the stories, for sure. This is always the way it is. There's always a disconnect between what the bad stuff that goes on, that everybody knows goes on, and what I guess you could call the mainstream press want to write about. I don't know why, but it's true. There always is. And in any case, one repressed memory that I didn't learn about until I was deep into the story, written 2 or 3 pieces, concerned this young man who did a lot of shooting. His name was Meadlow, as I said. He simply fired clip after clip. He was one of those, like an automat, just shot and shot into the ditch. They put people, as I said, in three large ditches. And after the shooting was over, the soldiers went and were eating their lunch, really, literally, next to the ditch, next to the bodies. And that's how disconnected you get. You dehumanize. You obviously have to dehumanize the enemy, as we listened to this morning. In any case, one mother had tucked a child, a 2 or 3-year-old boy, under her stomach, and somehow he survived all the bullets. And they heard a keening noise. The soldiers told me, and this little boy climbed his way up through the ditch, full of other people's blood, got to the top, and began to run. Across the, just to run away. And Lieutenant Callie turned to Meadlow, his most dependable shooter. Others had stopped at a certain point or shot high and said, Meadlow, plug him. And Meadlow looked at one person and couldn't do it. And Callie then with the great, very saucy-like, grabbed his carbine. Officers had a smaller rifle called a carbine, ran behind him and shot him. Everybody remembered that because the next morning, Meadlow was walking on patrol with the soldiers. They moved on to a few clicks away, a mile or so away, and began to patrol again, as they always did. Just another day's work, I guess. I don't know. And he stepped on a landmine, Meadlow did, and blew his right leg off at the knee. And when the medevac was coming, they called in a chopper to take him away. He began to issue an oath. God has punished me, Lieutenant Callie, and God will punish you. God has punished me. And the kids, in telling me about this a year and a half later, all remembered how angry they were. Get him out of here. Get him out of here. They didn't want to hear this. And anyway, I obviously went looking for him. What a story. It took me a long time. We didn't have internet then. I remember I was in Salt Lake City calling various. I knew he was from Indiana. I knew how to spell his name. I finally found the house, a town called New Goshen. I flew overnight to Chicago and then New Goshen is below Indianapolis, which is below Terre Haute, which is below. Anyway, it took me forever, and I finally found this house. And here's this old ramshackle chicken farm. Chickens all over the place, no man clearly around. And I had spoken to Milo's mother the night before, and she said, well, I don't know what it'll do. And I said, I'll be there the next day. And I show up, and she comes out to greet me. She's maybe 50, looks 70. Everything's in disrepair. And I said, I wanted to see her son. She said, he's in the house. And I said, may I go? And she said, I don't know if he'll talk to you. And then this woman, this sort of uneducated, rural woman from on the banks of the Wabash River in very south of southern Indiana, she looked at me and she said, very angry and very low, she said, I gave them a good boy, and they sent me back a murderer. And, you know, you hear those stories, and I'm right there. It's a moment you'll never forget. And no matter how much I write about it, I still think about it. And we're just hearing it today, all day, again and again. And the bottom line is, this is what war is.
Seymour Hersh, what about Larry Colburn? What about the guys who came down in the helicopter to try to stop this?
They did try to stop it. They jeopardized their career. They actually drew their weapons, which was quite amazing. And they did stop the, in the short term, they stopped the slaughter of a bunch of women and children who had taken a refuge in a cave or in a complex, in an underground complex. And they did stop them from being shot immediately. I don't know whether they were shot eventually or not.
What do you mean they drew their weapons? They drew their weapons on their fellow soldiers.
Yes. The machine gunners turned he was a door gunner, machine gun in a chopper. And they pointed them at their fellow soldiers, absolutely. Other soldiers in the unit, I think there were about 80 guys that went in, and I think I must have, in the next 6 months, talked to 50 or 60 of them. And there was a racial distinction that was interesting. I don't know. It seemed to me, just on the basis of what I talked of those I talked to, very rough, that the vast majority of the African-American and Hispanics shot, but shot high. It was just, you know, it was the white boys' deal, they thought. They were afraid not to shoot because they were afraid of getting a bullet from their fellow soldiers if they did not shoot. So they shot. And so you did have occasion. There was differentiation. Not everybody was an automat like Meadlow and shot everything every time an officer asked them to. There was distinctions. And Colburn and Thompson and the others, but they were waved off. Everybody was exceedingly angry at Thompson. When he got back, he was chewed out, you know, for being unprofessional, et cetera, et cetera. And Thompson, at one point, took a medal that talked about his bravery. It was sort of like he did do it. He was sorry he did it later. It was complicated because those who behaved correctly were the ones who were in the wrong in terms of what was going on that day.
Seymour Hersh, Gareth Border did a piece at antiwar.com, My Lai Probe Hid Policy That Led to Massacre. The whole issue of this being described as some kind of rogue operation that had no official sanction. And he said for decades it was accepted that the massacre by army troops was a violation of official policy directives. That the conclusion reached in the most definitive account of the My Lai massacre, the final report by General William Pierce, who investigated the question of responsibility in 69 and 70 for the Army. Documentary evidence from U.S. Army archives shows, however, Pierce's report misrepresented a key directive from the top commander in Vietnam, General William Westmoreland, describing it as a calling for a blanket policy of humane treatment of civilians. Gareth Porter says the directive made it clear the U.S. military command's policy was to consider the civilian population in long-term communist base areas as the enemy, which could be subjected to the same treatment as communist military personnel. The Pierce report description, which avoided quoting directly from the document, effectively covered up the actual intention of the command's policy toward noncombatants in places in My Lai. Directive 525-3 is not the only piece of evidence pointing to a military command policy of treating noncombatants in Viet Cong base areas as subject to indiscriminate violence. In his own memoir, General Westmoreland himself wrote, once the free fire zones were established, anybody who remained had to be considered an enemy combatant, and operations in those areas could be conducted without fear of civilian casualties. Your response?
Look, I spent a lot of years looking at it, and I can tell you, the notion that this was in any way justifiable was just not—it was just not brought up. There may indeed have been a piece of paper like that. You know what I mean? I can tell you that when I was doing the Abu Ghraib stuff in the New Yorker 3 or 4 years ago. Afterwards, there was all this talk about army regulations, about what's right and wrong. And I can tell you that when I was, I learned about Abu Ghraib 5 or 6 months before I could write about it, just because you had to get evidence. Nobody ever mentioned the word regulations to me. In other words, the whole notion that there were regulations of what you could or could not do. In the case of the Iraqi war, there was no limits on what you could do to prisoners, just don't get caught. In the case of the Vietnam, the only problem with Gareth Porter is a good reporter. I've known him for many years, and he certainly knows Vietnam better than anybody. He wrote a lot of great books about it back 2 or 3 decades ago. But in this case, it just never came up that there was any justification. Indeed, there were areas in free fire zones in which anybody who they would go, and the American position was we would say to people who had been farming in this area for who knows 1,000 years, their families, and suddenly declare it a free fire zone and offer them a chance to live in some prefabricated housing that we were building, and anybody who chose not to go was considered suspect, theoretically. But there was also a common sense approach, which was, in this case, there was no enemy combatants, there was no shooting, there was no opposition. Everybody understood this was just sheer, random, violent murder. So I don't think, without disagreeing with what he says, because I simply don't know, that defense was never raised at any point, that there was any justification. But, I would think.
But then, yes. The bigger point that this My Lai was not isolated. The idea, the Toledo Blade reporters who've done this remarkable job talking about the dozens of My Lai massacres that have never been documented.
To take what you're saying to its logical extension, essentially, the argument would be that anybody could shoot anybody at any time with, there would be there was just no laws at all. And clearly here in the case of My Lai, everybody knew something wrong had happened. There were immediate investigations and it was covered up, but it was considered scandalous and shameful upon subsequent investigation. Everybody knew a grave mass crime had been committed. And that doesn't add, of course, and Piers, I was very critical in the stuff I wrote, not only in the eventual books and stuff I wrote for The New Yorker back in the early 70s, very critical of Piers, because it turns out another unit of the same task force to which Charlie Company was attached, it was called Task Force Barker, I think there were three companies, they ended up killing over 100 people, innocent civilians, in a village a couple of miles away or less, MK4, or MK something, whatever it was called. And so clearly you had a pattern of very wild, indiscriminate fire, like we just heard in the winter in your earlier broadcast, soldiers just shooting randomly at cars. But I just have no evidence that I've known about that you could simply go into a village and shoot indiscriminately. You did. It happened often, but it was always considered to be a crime. And this was certainly considered by everybody at the time
and
to be a crime.
Your reflection now, as you hear an excerpt of Winter Soldier, we'll be doing these hearings all week on this 5th anniversary. No corporate media coverage of this weekend, remarkable gathering of hundreds of active duty soldiers as well as veterans describing their own experiences, echoing back to 71, the Winter Soldier hearings of Detroit, Michigan, almost got no coverage as well at the time.
I'm somebody who works in the straight press. I worked for The New York Times for 9 or 10 years in Washington, doing a lot of good stuff. And I'll tell you, I've been reluctant to come to it, but I have to tell you, the Main Street press in this administration, they've failed the First Amendment. Jefferson would be turning over in his grave. They've missed the great moral story of our time, which was the inadequate facts on which the president went to the war, extended the war from Afghanistan into Iraq. They've missed this complete. This is a presidency that, we have a president that uses words that, we do not, we don't torture.
We'll have
the
to leave it there.
The economy's going great.
Seymour Hersh,
well,
thanks for joining us. Our website,
sure.
democracynow.org, where you can get a copy of today's show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.